kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode number 85, with me, Di Barnes, and...
me, Doug Belshaw.
Oh, we've been having to explain.
Right, so as we know, Microsoft is the best company in the entire world, and they do everything out of the love of their heart, as we talked about with Minecraft last week. And they have, in their infinite wisdom, decided to turn Skype into, I don't know, Snapchat or something. And they're upgrading, force upgrading people off the existing version of Skype for Linux. We're both on Linux now, which is awesome, but also means that the solution that we were using to record this podcast no longer works.
Yes. So I had the newer version in because I can't no longer get the old version, even though I had it only a week ago, I think. And but the old version doesn't exist anymore, so you're forced towards the new version. Then the new version, our recording tool, doesn't work in the new version, isn't that right?
That's right. So we've been scrabbling around, and a while ago we saw something where you could record podcasts online. It wasn't this one, but it was similar, and this one's called Zencastr, with a C-A-S-T-R at the end, Zencastr. And you can record up to 8 hours free with just two people per month, which sounds perfect for us, as long as we keep under 2 hours.
I like a challenge.
But the good thing is you connect to your Dropbox account and it records each side of the audio into like a WAV file into your Dropbox. So you might have noticed, if you're listening to this regularly, that what happens is, and I noticed when I listen back, that because I'm recording it, sometimes I'll not realize that I'm saying something else. I'll basically talk over the top of them. That shouldn't happen as much now.
Yeah, it should be more equal, so you'd be able to put... sorry, I can't speak. Maybe you should just talk over the top of me. So we'll be fighting each out for the audio airwave, as it were. So anyway, cool. How are you?
I'm all right, yeah. Just kind of... Today, actually, I've been going down a rabbit hole of... So some work that... I do some critical friend work, as you know, and... one of the people I do that for, she's a consultant herself. She does work, a lot of work with the NHS. And because I don't have the domain expertise around kind of healthcare, she said it would be great if you could bring some fresh eyes and your knowledge around open education and digital literacies and just go hunting for me with some of the hours that I've got left with her in terms of doing some research for a report she's going to write. And so it's been really interesting looking at what open practices look like in the NHS. Mm. And of course, even the search terms that I'd use, like open practices, and if you type in open practices in NHS, you just get a list of when GP surgeries are open.
And here we come. I was thinking about this just this week, right? How the internet... searching is sort of broken, so you have to get like quite, because I've been looking for really quite difficult technical things, and you have to go beyond and beyond and beyond and really know your advanced search to actually find something that's useful to help you do what you want. If you want something specific and you only want instances like results that have dealt with the same issue or whatever, it's actually quite tricky, and that is a fantastic example of why.
Yeah, so I mean, I'd be really interested to explore how you go about doing that. But just quickly in terms of how I do this, and, you know, I did this for thesis and all that kind of stuff, where you really need to, like, almost go really far and deep into an area. I just search until I find the right search term. So in this case, it was digital professionalism. Which is a whole buzz term within the NHS at the moment, it seems. Mm-hmm. And then what had happened was, and sometimes it sparks something that you did in the past and you know a little bit about. So if you remember when I was at JISC, I kind of curated the Open Educational Resources Info Kit.
Yes.
And that came up in one of the searches, and it reminded me that Lou McGill and Helen Beetham and Alison Littlejohn had kind of written a report about all these UK OER projects. Anyway, long story short, one of those projects actually really did a great job in terms of looking at open practices within the NHS. Now, that was actually 2012, which is 5 years ago now. But what it did do was point me out in lots of different directions. And that, coupled with a couple of great articles I found via Google Scholar more recently, allowed me to kind of build a picture, because it's about finding where the edges are, as far as I'm concerned. Then you can start putting the jigsaw together. It's about like when you do the edges of the jigsaw and then you start putting the bits in.
Yep. Cool. Well, that's good that you got somewhere with it. Mm. Interesting that it went back to your own work of previous years.
You know what I mean? That's the deal. What do you do? Is it a similar kind of thing? Or?
I know. So I just trial and error, really, refining the search. So the thing I use is in Google search tools is time. So I always restrict the time to the last month or last year, depending on what the issue is that I'm looking. I mean, I've been looking at Linux stuff. So I've been looking for a work that's been done on version 16 of Ubuntu. Trying to get fixes with that. And then there's lots and lots of stuff that's irrelevant. So you just end up having to trawl through loads of things that are really quite irrelevant, and it just becomes difficult, hard work. I mean, that's what it is, isn't it? So, it just struck me that there are kind of cloaks out there hiding what it is something must be out there that about what you want. And you have to pull back these cloaks. It's quite difficult.
And I think that's where the bookmarking is really important, or certainly like curating links to stuff. If it's taking you ages to find something and you know that there's a good chance you might need it again, I think it's really important. I use Pinboard for that. But
Curation. I mean, we've talked about curation before, curating your own web, basically. And it becomes really, really important because you don't have a lot of time. So you need a fast method of metadata and tagging what you find that you think is going to be useful. But the important thing is, because it became like, you know, you could just go and search for something and you'll find it. And in many cases, that's true. So you don't really need to bookmark stuff in some cases, you know, but quite often you do, because the things you're looking for are actually quite unique and that kind of thing. So, and they get hidden underneath layers, and the more mature, or the more time passes over EdTech, for example, the more these things will disappear, the actual decent things, and they'll be covered up with something not so good, you know, and it's harder to find. So it makes sense to curate the web.
And the bizarre thing is, we get used to how good things like Apple's devices and Google search is. And it's only when you purposely start, I mean, it sounds weird to use something which is not best of breed in terms of like industry leading, but actually, you know, you're following other values like we are with Linux and openness and all that kind of stuff. So I use DuckDuckGo most of the time. Uh-huh. And today I kind of had to use Google because it seemed like some of the links I was trying to get to weren't even being indexed by DuckDuckGo. But at the same time, because I'm used to using a slightly suboptimal search engine, it reminded me that I need to bookmark this stuff because it'll be hard to find again.
Yes, and it's interesting, isn't it? So I've been experimenting with a plugin called Ecosia. Have you heard of that before? It's basically the ads that you receive in Ecosia. If you click on them, it plants trees, and it tells you how many trees you planted. After, you know, I think it's 9 advertising clicks or something, it plants a tree or something daft like that. And I don't know how real it is, but I've looked into it, and somebody wanted it to be the default search engine across the school, some eco kind of person.
Oh, I remember you saying that, yeah.
Yeah, and but it was just too many times I was clicking on the opens in Google, please, link on Ecosia.
Can you remember years ago, it must have been like turn of the millennium, the thing everyone was trying to have for their homepage was, like, if you click on this thing, it gives a free cup of rice to someone in a third world country.
Yes, that's a similar
thing. Do you ever go to that one?
I tried that for a while, and as well, just because I use the internet a lot, so therefore it would make sense. And it sort of does make sense, and then it doesn't, because at the end of the day, the speed of functionality becomes important, and it's a question of what you take on your inconveniences for, what you sacrifice that streamlined functionality for. So with Ecosia, they have been improving their web widget, and has more filters in it, but it's still just not as good. Like, if you want to do image searching, Google's tools are second to none that I've seen. And indeed, just with general web searching, as I say, the time thing in particular is really, really important.
Oh, I did something interesting yesterday, just for a bit of a laugh. So last year, I persuaded my parents to go for this. I mean, you know, once every year, Amazon has that those kind of blowout deals. What do they call them? You know, Amazon Day or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And things are really cheap, yeah? So I think the warranty's now expired, but I got them to buy. They got two Lenovo K5s. We've probably talked about this. Yeah. Anyway, end of the day, they got into much enthusiasm and then didn't use them very much. My mother went back to her old Windows phone. And my dad, I don't know if he did it on purpose, but managed to break the touchscreen on it. So I tried to return it. There seemed to be a never-ending loop on Lenovo's customer service in terms of mobile devices. Anyway, long story short, didn't get fixed. It's been sitting in the corner of my office for like 11 months. And the machine itself is fine. It's just the touchscreen doesn't work. And I don't really want to spend any money on it particularly. So I figured out the other day that you can use one of those mini USB to normal size USB adapters and then plug in a, stop me if I've already said this, you can plug in a wireless mouse and keyboard and then use Android with a cursor and a keyboard.
All right.
Have I said this already?
That's a cool little solution.
Yeah, so I did that. So I was basically using a 5-inch phone with a mouse and a keyboard. And then I thought, hang on a minute, I can make this completely interface free if I use OK Google. So I set it all up to do that. Uh-huh. And I my little Sony Cube speaker, I don't know if I've talked about this before, I've got two little Sony Cube speakers,
yeah.
One blue, one white. And they're great, and I use them when I'm traveling. And they're wonderful speakers in their own right. Very small, maybe a couple of, like 3 inches across, 3 inches kind of cube. And it's also a Bluetooth speaker. Like you can have phone calls on them as well. So if you connect it via Bluetooth, not only does it do the speaker functionality, but you can talk to it as well and do the OK Google stuff. So it's actually pretty cool. It's just the microphone wasn't sensitive enough, really. And also the fact that I didn't really want, it was an experiment. I didn't really want it in my house all the time. But we had a lot of fun with the kids just messing about with it. It was good.
Yeah, yeah, makes sense. And it shows you, isn't it? Because what the important thing is really is the a computer is the chip inside, you know, and RAM, yeah, and et cetera, doing its job. And if you can, it's just like a Raspberry Pi, really. If you can get the, you've got some output, you can get the inputs, and you're up and away. Cool.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, yeah. So quite enjoyed doing that. I mean, it was more of a, just a geeky thing to do rather than anything useful. But
Well, speaking of geeky things to do, so I've been trying to fix my new computer, and I did. I managed it. I am victorious. So I ended up trawling the web and trying to find things and getting very fed up and frustrated and sending messages to the guy who sold it to me. And he'd been ill for a couple of days, so he hadn't got back to them. And he was like, I don't really want you to send it back to China, so it will take longer than doing what? I don't know. But I'd got to the end of my tether with it. And then I gave it another go with a fresh pair of eyes and found a method to edit the grub configuration file. And I just put a little line of text inside one of the boot lines. And it worked. I mean, the problem stopped and the computer works fine. So I've been setting that up over the last couple of days. And and that was...
So you're still using Linux Mint, is that right?
No, it's on Ubuntu. It's on the LTS version.
16.04 or 17.04?
16.04.
Okay, so on the same one as me. Cool.
So far, so good. Happy days.
Excellent.
I've still got the fan issue.
So for anyone who's thinking about doing this, definitely do what Dai said and look at the forums and stuff. And the grub file is to do with the way that the operating system boots and the different arguments that you can pass to it in order to turn on and turn off different things.
Yes, so mine was some kind of hardware seating of the Wi-Fi chip inside wasn't working, so I've had the machine apart and made sure everything's plugged together properly, and that was all fine, and it was nothing to do with that. And I'd installed another operating system on top of it, and that had the same error had happened. And so it was struggling away, and then eventually found a way to... So one of the problems I did have is that I couldn't... So I only once managed to load it so that I had the grub choices. So these are four different possible choices that you get, a bit like if you're dual booting, you choose between operating systems, a bit like that, but you can choose different versions, like a recovery version of Ubuntu, etc., to get into. And once you're in that, you can press the letter E and edit the actual lines of code that it runs as it picks up the ROM. And And that's what I did. And it only worked once. And then I edited the grub file and committed the edit to memory and through terminal. And Bob's your uncle. Compute work.
And the one, like we said last week, the wonderful thing about that is you feel like some kind of superhero when you, once you've actually fixed it.
I was absolutely shocked. I couldn't believe it. I'd really, really sort of given up more or less, thinking, what the hell am I going to do with this thing, and taking it apart, and thought, right, can I buy another case for it? Can I, you know, what do I do? Mm. Get another motherboard and use the processor, or, you know, what can I do? And
but this is personal computing as opposed to just basically being tethered to an Apple device.
Yes. So, but just, I mean, it sounds a bit ironic, really, but just rather than buying something that just works out straight out of the box, you've got some work to do, you know, you have to, it's important that you do that work. So, interesting. And
yeah, and the chances are, if you do the work, you're more likely to, well, not only is it more upgradable, but also you're more likely to keep it for longer, which is, you know, more sustainable and healthier for the environment and stuff. So it's all good.
No, absolutely, absolutely. So I'm very happy anyway.
I have started off something. I started this off a few weeks ago, but I realized actually I was going to keep going with it, I guess, last week. So I've got a newsletter, as you know, called Thought Shrapnel. And I thought what I want to do is not only just kind of share, curate all my links and have them there and then whack them in a newsletter every Saturday night to go out Sunday morning. What I want to do is share them with people. And I kind of hummed and hawed as to whether this was going to be a bit like Slack and like a back channel like Christian Payne has to his newsletter Documentally, where people are having a bit of a chat. And I thought, well, actually, there's plenty of places where people are having a chat. Maybe it's just somewhere where I stick some links with a bit of commentary, like a couple of lines, and just send it out randomly when I come across it. And I think there's about 16 people in there now. And I know it's my dad, but he was saying last night when I was watching my daughter play football, just how useful he finds it and how interesting it is. So,
well, it's interesting, isn't it? So, because you're coming into, you're pushing it into a stream, aren't you? And that important that you're going into, like you're going into your father's stream that's convenient to him. Just like we talk about with the rivers, you know, it's feeding out into the right places for people. Yeah. However, can you access it on the web?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
So if you, if you sign up to Telegram, you can sign up to Telegram on the web. So the address is web.telegram.org. Telegram is open source as well. I'm using it right now, so it's in front of me. I've got my channel with my wife, my mother, my dad, the one with myself, which sounds bizarre, but it's a really good way of sending things between devices. My son, updates from Telegram, and I've got Thought Shrapnel live. As an administrator, I can see who's in the channel. Other members of the channel can't see each other. There's 17 people in there at the moment. And I can see how many people have viewed each thing that I've sent out.
Oh, okay. I'm just trying to.
So I don't get any feedback, and I don't get any like likes or anything like that, but I can see how many people viewed it. And I'm just going to keep going and see. I might put an arbitrary number on to see if I can get to a certain number by a certain time. And if I can, I'll keep it going. If I can't, I won't. But it just means I've then got a stream that I can just, not only will I bookmark it and put it in pocket and stuff, I'll send it out there. Then I've got a nice stream to easily not only get the link, but what I was saying about the link when I saw it.
So, right, I'm on it now. Right, let me see. I'm now on the Telegram web version. So let's click on your link and open in Telegram web. There it is.
Is it working?
Yeah, I'm in. Fantastic. So I got it on my phone, but I hadn't got it on here just this evening. So you wouldn't have seen any of my behavior.
Okay.
Cool. So have you done that instead of sending out an actual newsletter, or have you done both?
So what do you say? Instead of doing a newsletter?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Are you still there?
I am still here. Can you not hear me anymore?
You just went away for a second there.
Okay. Don't know why that is. Hang on.
Okay. Sorry, what you're saying, instead of a newsletter? Or?
Yeah. Have you done a newsletter as well, or have you just done that?
No. So I did my newsletter at the weekend, and then I guess as soon as I've scheduled my newsletter, any links that I'm sharing from that point on are candidates for the next one. Although what happened last week was that there was there's always so many links that I come across die that I haven't got enough space. I mean, I put in every week, I put in 25 links into my newsletter. So there's three sections of five, which have a theme. Each section has a theme. And then I have 10 links that don't fit into there. And there's always more than 25 links. So the chances are over the course of the week, I'm going to share many more than 25 links. Like I've shared 4 or 5 today. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's cool. Interesting. Mm. So no one replies. Do people reply?
Well, they unless I make them an administrator, they can't reply.
Oh, okay. I see. So there's no. So if I join that.
Mm. See, there's a difference between, you know, let's use WhatsApp as an example because it's similar. So with WhatsApp, you can create a group. So, you know, like we've got MPs subverting democracy through WhatsApp groups. Uh-huh. They can talk to each other through that. But there's also public channels, and this is a public channel, which is different from a closed, just membership channel.
Oh, okay, I see.
Anyone can join us. I can kick people out, but I can't. There's no application method for coming in.
So I've just joined it, so it's come into my timeline, as it were, and I'd be able to go back and check it quite easily. So I wonder if you post a new one, and whether I get a notification that you've posted something new.
Yes, you should do.
Like a text message.
Shall I just stick it in here? I'm going to put in one about HubSpot's inbound marketing. So there we go. Oh, live tweeting, live telegramming here, people.
Oh, yeah, no, I've got notifications on the desktop as well. Very good.
Mm. So I use Telegram on the desktop quite often when I'm out here in the office and my wife's in the house. We have little conversations instead of us having to walk backwards and forwards because we're lazy. Right.
Cool. Very good. Well, that's an interesting development. People can sign up to your links that you're putting out just particularly, and it's sort of a... Because I find this as well, it's a bit like how I've been using Twitter. You kind of want it to be a bit more privileged. You know, you want some things to... Not just to get the general flood of things, but you want to be able to privilege some things and look at particular people. So I have a channel on Twitter, a list on Twitter, that is just a handful of people, so that I can go and see what they're doing with their day, you know, that sort of thing. It's really good. I like it.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes. Cool. Anyway. Right. So last time we spoke was actually, so we're recording this on Tuesday, the 13th of June. It's only been a few days since the general election. And in fact, we recorded the last episode on the day of the general election, didn't we?
We certainly did, yeah. So I had a late night that night watching the first of the polls or the wards being declared. And Jeremy Corbyn did quite well and Theresa May won.
Well, it was bizarre, wasn't it? Because he celebrated as if he'd won, but of course he didn't win. Yes. And we've now got the bizarre situation where Theresa May is basically saying, "Oh, I got us into this mess. I'll get us out," as if business is normal. Forming some kind of coalition with the DUP, who are crazy right wing, like evolution denying, gay rights hating, like unenvironmentalists. Let's destroy the world. So it's been an interesting time. So instead of getting into kind of despair and all that kind of stuff, just a couple of things that I came across. I don't know if you saw this from the New Yorker, the book of Jeremy Corbyn. You see that?
I didn't see that, no. What's that all about?
Well, this is hilarious. So obviously it takes the style of an Old Testament book, and the photo on top is him having his hands together.
As if in prayer.
And I'll just read the start of it because you read the start of it because it's hilarious. Don't.
And it came to pass in the land of Britain that the high priestess went unto the people and said, "Behold, I bring ye tidings of great joy, for on the 8th day of the 6th month there shall be a general election." And the people said, "Not another one." And they waxed wroth against the high priestess and said, "Didst thou not swear, even unto 7 times, that thou wouldst not call a snap election?" And the High Priestess said, I know, but Brexit has come upon us, and I must go into battle against the tribes of France, Germany, and sundry other holiday destinations. That's superb.
And it goes on and on.
And vote.
Oh, it's really good. So that made me chuckle after kind of the despair of everything. So I woke up, it's about, I woke up at 4:15 because an alarm I'd set for when I was in Dubai randomly went off, annoyingly, and I couldn't go back to sleep. So I got up and just saw things unfolding from just before 5:00, which was, you know, I was just transfixed. It was crazy. But the only thing I will mention is that Theresa May, according to The Independent, is still trying to go ahead with her wide-ranging internet regulation and security changes despite not winning a majority.
Oh, well, this is quite an interesting thing, isn't it? So that's the, she's still going to try and get ahead with that. That is the case.
Apparently so, yeah.
It's trying to load a video for me.
I mean, ostensibly, the reason for it is cracking down on the ideology of Islamist extremism and all those who support it.
Well, yeah, that's clear.
Sorry, that was auto-playing video.
That's clearly what she's trying to do, but it's never going to work. So that's going to be an interesting thing to see what goes on.
I mean, the fact that she comes across as like, oh, Vicar's daughter, oh, a bit nervous and stuff. But the fact that she's put Michael Gove, who was trying to get climate change taken off the curriculum as was environment minister, and putting Jeremy Hunt back in charge of the NHS, like, oh my goodness.
No, I know, I couldn't agree more. It's all a little bit chaotic. So my take on this, so I watched on Sunday morning, I think, the Andrew Marr show, who is a political journalist and it has a weekly show on a Sunday morning, interviewing politicians. And Jeremy Corbyn was on there and he was, extraordinarily good, I have to say. And he actually has, so I think in 1974, I think there's a precedent for, a government that hasn't secured a majority to be, stopped and that Labour could rule from a minority, or govern, sorry, not rule. And yeah, so that's quite interesting. So he's actually got a battle plan together to actually take the Conservative Party down, and not get allow them to govern. And yeah, we'll see what happens. It should be interesting.
I mean, from what I've read, I didn't know what the, so it's not a, what Theresa May is seeking is not a coalition as such. I'd hope not, given the craziness of the DUP, but, what she's trying to do is organise a confidence and supply arrangement, which I didn't know what it was until I looked it up, and it's basically giving them a free hand apart from when it comes to things to do with confidence in the government or supplying things which get through their core policies of the manifesto in return for concessions, money, all that kind of stuff. So someone said it's a bit like Theresa May's government being on life support and the DUP being able to pull the plug at any moment.
Yes, it is a bit like that. And interestingly, Theresa May is meeting the woman who's in charge of the DUP today, I think, and I haven't seen any news yet about the results of that meeting where they're going to actually strike the deal. So at the weekend, they agreed that they would agree on something and have this sort of coalition, as it were. So today is the day when they're going to meet and actually decide what those things are. So essentially the DUP party will put in certain demands that the Conservative Party must meet for the DUP to support them in the things that they want to do. Mm. We'll see what they are, because the DUP are a bunch of nutters, basically.
This is true. This is true. I mean, the election has been analysed to death, so let's not spend too long on it, apart from, you know, let's not mourn the complete demise of UKIP. Let's just have a little celebration there.
Yeah, there was much to be sort of positive about, or bits to be positive about, even though the outcome wasn't to either of our liking.
Yes, yes, yes. Right, so I've just stuck some random links in here. Is there anything which kind of jumps out at you in particular? Anything that you've already had a look at, etc.?
No. Oh, Walking Away by Steve...
Well, now I want to talk about, Steve Wheeler, who will be familiar to most people, I guess, who listen to this podcasts, associate professor of, or senior lecturer of, like education technology at Plymouth University. He, after being there for 20 years in higher education, he's taking voluntary redundancy.
He is, yeah. So he was informed that the computing and ICT specialism that he has helped to develop and deliver the last 10 years has been cut from the B.Ed. primary teacher education program. I don't know, but if I were him and what was going on nationally at the moment, I wouldn't have ICT in the name of my course. because I just know how out of favor it is, and it's all about computing and computer science and coding and programming and all related computational thinking and related things like that. But I don't know why this has happened. So do you know why his course has been cut? Does he have an explanation of why?
No, I don't know the backstory of this. I know that Oliver Quinlan, Oliver Quinlan was at Plymouth University before he was at Nesta, and he went from Nesta to the Raspberry Pi Foundation where he is now. So it's been a while since Oliver was there, but I think Oliver helped define some of that. Mm-hmm. As you say, like the wind changes, times change, etc.
Well, that's just the only thing that struck me is that
there's a useful quote in here actually. I think Steve's pretty balanced. He sounds. Yeah, I haven't spoken to him. I haven't really spoken to anyone who's spoken to him. But he sounds slightly hurt here, understandably so. And he's trying to put a brave face on it. But this paragraph here, I'll just read on the upside, and this is why I'm smiling. I certainly won't miss the petty bureaucracy that's on the increase at a university near you. Ask anyone who works there, they'll tell you. There are now so many forms to fill in, regulations to abide by, and rules to follow. It's a wonder there's any academic freedom left, or any time to think. Nor will I miss the... And he crosses out penny pinching and replaces it with austerity. Most higher education leaders are now ruled by their accountants and finance officers, who seem to think that the most important mission for universities is to make money. The balance sheet, it appears, carries more weight than quality pedagogy. It seems to me that the sole reason university heads emphasize student experience is because they want to maintain a positive image from good feedback on the annual National Student Survey forms. Their key desire is to stay near the top of the league table. I won't miss the exam boards, budget cuts, tedious markup loads and reports, the research excellence framework, Ofsted inspections, the academic offence committees, mandatory compliance training days, the ethics boards, and the interminable meetings that could easily have been conducted by email. End of quote.
That's fair enough. So a lot of those complaints are very specific to higher education in general, and to so generic, therefore, and specific to his organisation as well and what's going on in his organisation. But I think a lot of people recognise some of those things in their jobs, if not yourself, but I have to do quite a lot of that sort of thing. But I think it's, Steve, if you're listening to this, which I don't think you do, but it's, good luck, and I hope everything goes well for you. I do wish him well. It isn't, every cloud has a silver lining and all that kind of thing. It is an opportunity to do something new and change direction in life, and it's going to be hard to.
Like, I don't know how old he is, but the fact that he says that he's not retiring, I'd imagine he's in his 50s, and certainly my dad was forced into reinventing himself in his 50s from a vindictive boss who basically did a hatchet job on him, but it really, gave my dad a new lease of life in the last 10 years of his career. So I don't think that's happened here particularly, but I think that Steve's got such a worldwide reputation and presence, he'll actually probably feel quite liberated.
Yeah, I think so, and this is picking up on that. I mean, you said he's putting a brave face on it, but I think he's actually, there'll be part of it, and they're thinking, oh, wow, I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 12 months' time. And that's really quite an exciting proposition once you've accepted the major change that's going to happen. So it could be good.
But there are big changes. I mean, I saw today, so I think it's Simon Horrocks, is it? The Vice Chancellor of the Open University. Like, they're making massive cuts, like 25% or something. Mm-hmm. Trying not to have too much impact on staff, but obviously people are going to have to go, be made redundant, be redeployed. And I think Manchester was in a similar position as well. It's basically, Di, organisations who have thrived in an analog world not having necessarily responded as quickly as they possibly should have done in the digital era.
Yes, I think. Do you think it's just this? I don't think it's just that. I think there's other things going on.
It's not just that, but that's one of the things.
I think that's definitely a factor, because I don't know what an organization that is thriving in the digital era looks like, particularly.
But anything that's got a brand, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? And certainly if I was in a higher education organization, I would be looking at exploiting the opportunities that the internet provides and what that means for my organization. Certainly, especially when so many people are going out there learning new stuff, you know, and paying money for it online.
Well, talking about that, I mean, that's a nice link actually into the next link, which is Education Unbundled. What knowledge will we lose if we automate the professions? Which is not exactly what Steve's talking about in his post, but he does talk about, you know, what are we throwing away when we get rid of the amount of expertise that we're culling from organizations? Mm-hmm. And this one, Benjamin Dockstader, who I've only come across recently, actually, he and I looked like we disagreed with something a couple of months ago on Twitter, and we had a bit of a... We basically hugged it out on Twitter, and it turns out that we were both on the same side.
Uh-huh. So what does he write about here?
Benjamin's post is basically a critique of Richard and Daniel Susskind's book, The Future of the Professions, How Technology Will Transform the Work of Human Experts, from 2015. So I don't know what his current position is, or this looks like he's doing it for a particular purpose rather than just being a random blog post. But it's quite nice. I mean, he breaks it down into free market fantasies in the age of internet centrism, the consolidation of big data, unbundling education, de-skilling the planet. And at the end, he talks about economic planning for everyone. But his point here is that, like, you can't just unbundle it. If you scroll down to the bit where it says unbundling education, die, you can't just unbundle education and think that you get the same results just in smaller chunks, because that's not the way things work, as Steve was alluding to in his post.
Yes, I think both you and I would be very sympathetic with what this seems to be talking about. So I was just discussing data today, actually, with the assistant director of studies here at my school, and how we could use, you know, what good use of data looks like. Which is not drowning people in data, but only giving them enough making data available to them so they can do what they wish with it, but also giving them, making sure that there's a benchmark of enough data to inform decision making, rather than assemble fantastic sets of data. And just look at these trends, aren't they amazing and interesting? But actually, if you don't have a consequence in human action, you know, someone's behavior isn't changing because of that data, then the data is just, you know, irrelevant, really. It's worthless.
There's a few paragraphs here. There's three paragraphs starting from overall the Susskind section on education. You see that bit? I think it'd be worth just going through that, because it kind of gets to the nub of something. And just by way of visual metaphor for those who have seen Brian Mather's work and recognize this particular image, there's a wonderful image that Brian's got which illustrates just a nice subtle point between standardization and standards. And on the left-hand side, I think, or one side, he's got a McDonald's badge, you know, with people getting their 5 stars, that's standardization, versus like a Michelin-starred chef getting a Michelin star for reaching a particular amazingly high standard, but it's not like they have to do the same thing as everyone else. And he kind of refers to that in this. So do you want to do the middle paragraph and I'll do the...
So I'm doing overall, am I?
Okay, you start there and I'll do the middle one. Yep.
Overall, the Susskind's section on education exemplifies a larger pattern where they list various technological changes that have happened, but offer no critical assessment of whether or not they help bring about a more equitable world. In their catalogue of changes that excite them, they briefly mention personalised learning systems, Edutopia, Moodle, Khan Academy, Edomo, I think that's meant to be Edmodo. I don't know. Is that something? Yeah. MOOCs.
No, it's
learning management systems, and compare online intelligent tutoring systems to the tutor system at Oxford.
which is ridiculous. Sure, Khan Academy videos and adaptive software can offer a personalized learning experience, but they fall far short from the experience of discussing a book with a teacher or tutor. In fact, those personalized experiences are a kind of mass standardization, more like a McDonald's than like a chef at a restaurant who customizes meals based on what customers want to eat. And while adaptive software might quickly tell students when they have the right or wrong answer, it won't be able to have a conversation about how a novel inspires their dreams for the future.
In the unbundled view of education, the constructivist dream of a teacher as facilitator would come true. Perhaps these facilitators would simply shuffle kids from Khan Academy to the lunchroom to an adaptive test. Throughout the book, the Susskinds lean heavily on the cases they present in this chapter, arguing that it is simply not the experience of those who are working at the vanguard of the professions that, as David Auteur argues, many of the tasks currently bundled into these jobs cannot readily be unbundled without a substantial drop in quality.
Yep, I think that's absolutely exactly right.
I think that, and it is really interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, whenever I think of the classroom and I think of what a teacher adds to it, it's not just about the knowledge and the push and pull on the subject matter that's going on. It's so much about the sort of the smile and the facial expressions and the gestures and the encouragement and the reaffirmation of risk and or taking a risk and congratulating them and all those micro behaviors are lost online. Yeah. And I mean, that's part of why, people who don't understand when they send an email and somebody completely misinterprets it is because they don't appreciate what your body language or the micro gestures in your conversation are achieving.
And I think you can get some of that. I definitely would always privilege, face-to-face interaction, that kind of stuff. I think there's a bandwidth there, which is important. I think doing something which is personalized, like I'm talking to just you, Di, and trying to teach you something or trying to teach me something, or in a small group where you're personalizing it to the people in that group, I think even that is more valuable than what is going on, what they're talking about here, which is like a selection of things, which is pick and mix, and it's like an algorithm deciding what you do next, but like Khan Academy. Oh, you did this, therefore you should go on to this next, etc. I think there's a place for that, but so people have asked me a few times, why haven't you done, it would seem like the most obvious thing in the world for me to have already created a course around digital literacies, which issues open badges at the end. Yeah. And it would be, in some ways, although it would take me time to put together, the easiest thing in the world for me to go, here's lesson one, here's lesson two, here's lesson three, etc. Ding, 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 ding. Pay this amount of money, open badge, there you go. And you could do it at scale. And I've seen people do the equivalent of that for like maths and stuff in the US.
Yeah.
But the value in that would actually comes in getting feedback from the expert and getting feedback from the person who knows their stuff. But of course, to do that, you'd have to have a much smaller cohort who, to make it worthwhile, you'd have to charge a lot more. So yeah, I would do it if people were willing to pay like 500 quid a course, but no one is.
No,
so
exactly. And that's the true thing. Or indeed give up the time to something that's not, that their time isn't given up to. Do you know what I mean? So stuff that isn't timetabled into my curriculum, it doesn't get done unless I decide to do it. And so I have to have that motivation to make that happen. The social interaction within an online course is really, really important. And there's lots of studies that have shown that. And the most successful completion rates on courses are for those with a social element to them, between the learners, as it were, the people taking the course, as well as, tutors, who are guiding people through the course. And it's essentially that same thing. It's how do you replace the human element in an online forum? That's it, and that's really, really important. It's exactly what you say, is that rather, so what happens if, so we're talking about the Open University, and a lecturer there is called Kate Sim at Miss Attack on Twitter, spelt with her name Kate Sim backwards, I think she's a coding professor, and she came to my school once upon a time to, she also does stuff for RoboCup as well.
I think she turned up to EdTech Roundup back in the day.
Yes, she did, absolutely. Lovely lady. And But she did an Adobe Connect course recently, which she was required to do to keep up to scratch for her for the teaching that she does. She works for the Open University, so a lot of it's done remotely, I imagine. And she just found the course to be incredibly patronizing because there was no sort of fast track for somebody who is very technologically capable, and which she is. So and so she found it to be very disaffecting. But because the course is set out in the way that it is, you have to go through and jump through all the hoops. And it's just like GCSE ICT coursework. It was just like, have you jumped through this hoop? It doesn't matter how good you are with a tech. Have you jumped through this hoop? Because, you know, this is how it's going to be marked. You must have done this thing. And and which is why I stopped teaching it, because it was so awful.
Right.
So and that's the sort of thing whereby, even if you are, you know, you were talking about how certain organizations maybe haven't kept up to speed with the times that are changing. But though you can also keep up to speed, but do it in completely the wrong way. I think, which is quite interesting.
No, that, I think that's a really important point, actually, Di. Like, you can be on the bleeding edge of technology, buzzwords, everything like that, and actually be doing stuff which is entirely wrong for the people who are who you're serving, learners, customers.
Yeah, so Free Code Camp, we mentioned last week or a couple of weeks ago, they're offering different ways of learning programming and trying to help people become developers and actually secure income through the through what they've learned on their courses. But the, what they, their approach to it is very, very different. So they just set a lot of projects and they don't care how you do the projects, but they don't spoon feed you the code required to do them. So you can go out and use all sorts of different tools and then you just upload or link to the project that you've made. And that's a really interesting way of doing it, I think.
Okay. Well, let's just move on to the next article, which is The Silicon Valley Billionaires Remaking America's Schools. This is a New York Times article. It's quite a long one. It's got some very cheesy imagery of people like Mark Zuckerberg, the guy who's CEO of Salesforce, who's Mark Benioff, those kinds of people. And obviously, in the US, you've got pretty much unfettered capitalism, especially under Trump. And there's a bit in here where it just says, you know, these philanthropic efforts. It says tech companies and their founders have been rolling out programs in America's public schools with relatively few checks and balances. The New York Times found in interviews with more than 100 company executives, government officials, school administrators, researchers, teachers, parents, and students. They have the power to change policy, but no corresponding check on their power, said Megan Tompkins-Stange, an assistant professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. It does subvert the democratic process. End of quote.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? And it's one of those things, so it's a sunshine factor as well. When people tell you sunshine stories, I always call them. So whenever you go and ask somebody, we've just been looking at a piece of software last week. I had a meeting about it, an online meeting. And there were three of us watching them do a webinar about a piece of software called Boardingware, which deals with all of the things that go on within a boarding house. And it turns everything digital, which is great, but it costs £9,000 a year for our school. So it's something, however much per pupil per month. And we have nearly 1,000 boarders. So it was great. But we were talking about, well, let's go and talk to other schools about it. But if you go to another school that's bought the product, then you get a sunshine story. So if you talk to the people who brought that product in. So I said, the best way to do this is find out which schools are doing it and not to talk to the person who brought it in, but to try and find somebody else who knows a teacher in that school and says, and you ask them, oh, what's it like? And just in a very informal way. And that way you get the non-sunshine story. You know, you get the real weather. And I recommend people do that if they're talking to other schools about what they do.
No, I think that's a really important point, actually. And what I find really interesting about this article is that, you know, it's talking about philanthropy, which you think, well, what can be wrong with that? But as I've said many times before on this podcast, I'd point to lots of the things that the Gates Foundation have done, for example, which, you know, if you look at, like, objective analysis of this and even analysis by their own organization, some of the stuff, small school initiatives, etc., just haven't worked at all and have been pretty dangerous and messed up education for you know, quite a lot of kids. In this case, and I read something this week, Di, which was talking about how people like Donald Trump, et cetera, have almost got, they've spent their careers trying to influence, potentially bribe, I don't know, politicians to do their bidding. And it's almost like they've got so sick of that, they've decided just to, like, get rid of the politicians and go straight and do it themselves. And it seems like a similar thing here. It's all under the banner of philanthropy, but obviously there's tax and deductible issues here. And it's almost like, well, get out the way, people in the way. Let's just go straight for the jugular. And someone describes the guy, Mark Benioff, chief executive of Salesforce, as being like a public sector venture capitalist in the way that he's running, the way he's funding some of the schools he's funding.
Mm. No, I think that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Because, and it also makes me think about, so there's lines up here about Microsoft pushing code.org, which has barnstormed the country, to quote the article. And you keep thinking it's going to be a good thing, but really it's, you don't know what it is that Microsoft have picked up on about code.org that is really good, and they're pushing them and putting their money and their sort of, I guess, political muscle behind them. And then that thing is there in 120 districts to introduce their curriculum. And that's amazing if it's good. But if it's not good, then you're kind of, that's really bad, you know? And that's the, I mean, that's the danger of the billionaire buck, isn't it, really? As you say, it's done on a whim, potentially. I mean, you assume that these people are discerning in some way, and hopefully, you know, hopefully Microsoft, I mean, Microsoft have many, many very talented people working for them. But they do seem to, not be so good at the bigger picture somehow.
Weird. If you look through some of this stuff here, like, it just seems very like, if you took education out of the mix, you could imagine this story was just about, I don't know, like business in general. There's a company called Dreambox, which I haven't actually heard of. Dreambox Learning. It wasn't doing so well. Just this particular, it was a maths program that does games-based education, personalized learning, adaptive learning, whatever. Wasn't doing so well. And then the CEO of Netflix stepped in, donated $11 million, and now 2 million students use the program. And apparently it's so addictive, students just get sucked in completely, and it's all games-based and stuff. And you think, well, that's fine, but then you've got people like Mark Zuckerberg, who seem to be just touting Facebook as the platform for everything, and that everyone can teach themselves. But like, Siddhartha Mitra, but instead of it being groups, it's individuals in front of computers, as far as I can gather.
Individuals behind big tech companies, really.
Yeah, yeah, and it's all in, you know, it's not based, it might be based on some research, but it's not based on, like, if there is a consensus, but, you know, like, things which lots of academics would agree on. It's like, I woke up this morning thinking about this thing. I think that's a good idea. Oh, look, this person who I'm shoveling lots of money to thinks it's a good idea too. Let's go and do it. And they can do it straight away because there's no checks and balances. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Money talks.
Well, it does. It does. And yeah, that's a nice link to Audrey Waters' one about the history of personalized learning, actually. So she's been in Iceland. I really wanted to, well, not really wanted to. I quite fancied going to the Online Educa. It initially stands for Online Educa Berlin, OEB. But they've got this mid-summit, and she keynoted it, and she called it Pigeons and Personalization, the Histories of Personalized Learning.
I didn't see this, no.
So I've only scanned it, but it's quite... I mean, she always writes a new keynote, and I think she does a great job in doing that, as I said in my newsletter. But there's a few, you know, as ever, there's themes and things which come up time and time again. And I think it's important that she keeps saying this kind of stuff about, where did personalized learning originate? Like, why do people keep going on about it? It's not like there's a single history of it. She says, in this 20-minute talk, I'm going to offer you several histories, origins, and trajectories of personalization more broadly, as a cultural, not just a technological or pedagogical practice. She uses all kinds of stuff from Google's Ngram viewer she riffs off, you know, the Coke bottle being named after, you know, you, all this kind of stuff. It's really quite interesting.
It is. It's interesting where the principle of personalization comes from. I think it's a really interesting thing, what is meant by personalized learning. So at a school of our sort, I listened to Martin Robinson the other day, who is the Trivium guy, and he came to our school to talk. And I listened to him, it's about a month ago or so, and he was talking about the motivation behind what he was saying was that you were inviting, by doing Trivium, you were inviting pupils into to build on the conversation that had been going on for 2,000 years. And that was the important thing in all fields. So in art, like in music, in philosophy, whatever it might be, is that, and it's this interesting thing of that is not individualism. Do you know what I mean? So if you hark back to what we talked about, Adam Curtis last week, and he was saying how there are, so, you know, liberals are dreadful at putting, achieving any momentum behind their cause, and whereas the right wing seems to be much better at it, and this was kind of part of it, really, is that there is stuff that you need to go and learn. If you want to get into the conversation isn't just a thing that exists between you and me, Doug. It's that what we're trying to do is,
It's the society thing, And all of this gets recast as being like an economic argument. So money gets in the way of every single interaction and every single relationship. So in this particular one, where Mark Zuckerberg's talking about how you can have individuals on their own trajectories and self-pacing and all this kind of stuff, it's the neoliberal dream. It's basically putting all of the onus on the individual for whether they succeed or not economically. And in Audrey Waters' article, her second to last paragraph is, quote, when Betsy DeVos, which is the new American Secretary of State, when Betsy DeVos and others say that we need to be really intent on focusing on the needs of each individual student, what she doesn't add is that all risk in this worldview would fall on the individual as well, of course. In a world with no institutions, unbundled and disintermediated as Silicon Valley is clearly keen to do, there are no institutional protections. With no government oversight, there is no appeal to civil rights.
Absolutely. And that's the big deal, isn't it? The big deal is that we want a society which is governed. You know, you don't want a society without that. And one of the things that I think that you and I keep harking back to is the idea that governance is happening by these big tech corps, as was illustrated in the last article, relating to education, and indeed these massive investments that these big tech corp owners can do. And Audrey's picking out here this idea of personalized learning. Well, to me, personalized learning means that a human being judges that somebody can move faster. So looking at Kate, for example, on her Adobe Connect course, is that I know that she's finding it hard work because her ability is much higher than what the course is offering. So you set up some different resources for her to do and some different track for her to follow, and which isn't irrelevant and is still purposeful, but develops her in a personal way. And that to me is personalized learning. Personalized learning is possibly getting a bad name, because it's about individualism, and that's not what it's about. It's about how individuals join the river, I guess, or the flow of.
But it's a perfect example, isn't it, of any time, and this is a broader problem, I guess. Any time, you know, we talk about open washing, green washing, anything where you come up with a term, and then, without wanting to make it too kind of left and right, you get basically people who are trying to make the world a better place coming up with the term to try and bring people together. And then you get people hijacking that term, like personalization, and using it to make money. And I'm sure the first people who did that didn't think they were doing anything bad. But I think by now, I think, you know, people are pretty sure what they're doing. They're hijacking that word to mean sitting kids in front of a computer and snacking on different things and putting together a playlist for them.
Yeah.
And Yeah.
That's it. I remember we talked about the schools in Silicon Valley before, didn't we? About these very small schools that had very few people in them. They were built in houses. And they had Google programmers working, so they were developing systems that were incredibly fast and responsive in the classroom, but also that had these algorithms that were personalizing content towards the learner. And that is their drive, you know, underneath all of that, if you think about it. So rather than trusting the teacher to personalize the learning to the learner, and to sort of say, okay, I can see that you have different needs to what are being offered here, you're trying to get a computer to do it. And if you unpack that, what they're trying to do is to automate automate the professor, automate the teacher's role, which is, you know, is surely going to fail.
Yeah, exactly. And I think all of that kind of let's get as much data as possible means that kids are inside in front of computers or screens quite a lot, which is in this article, which is next, the Schools Don't Prepare Children for Life, Here's the Education They Really Need, by Rhiannon Lucy Coslett in The Guardian. There's an image here of, you know, kids outside, forest schools, that kind of stuff. That's exactly the kind of thing that is difficult to measure, isn't it?
Very much. Very much so. And yeah, I think it's quite interesting that I think the information is out there, you know, about what a good education is and how you can change education. I think outdoor education has a lot to speak for it. I think we've talked about the sort of activities that allow a young person to meet their needs, and but also not to be scared of boring students because they have to learn this stuff or they have to have this conversation about something that they're not particularly interested in or something.
I'm not sure that. I hear that argument quite a lot about people need to learn to be bored, right? And I think we almost need a taxonomy of boredom, because I think there's different types of boredom.
My housemaster just passed, and this boy's making noise. Sorry, outside my door as I was speaking. What I mean is that people need to tolerate, to learn tolerance. I don't think people need to learn to be bored. They need to be able to tolerate things that they find difficult, tolerate things that are not piquing their interest at that moment, and to push through with things. That's really what I mean, is there is a lot of stuff out there to learn, and people need to get on with learning it, I think. That's the important thing.
Okay. I just say that because I think that anything which is worth knowing can be learned in an interesting way. That's what I mean.
Yes, I agree.
So, I mean, it'll be hard to disagree with anything on this list. You know, let's not go in detail, but she references the French baccalaureate. She talks about some of the books which Michael Gove dispensed with, which were all about helping children grow in confidence and stressing the importance of kindness and tolerance. Talk about financial literacy, coding, relationships education, PSHE, politics, healthy eating, citizenship, and there's a really nice bit where she says the focus of any curriculum should not be on attainment and resilience, the current buzzword, but on producing confident, well-rounded citizens who feel as though they belong and have value in society, which I think is a great thing, because I feel like people look to private schools, probably like yours, Di, and say, well, what we need is we want confident, resilient young men and women like private schools produce. And of course, it's not just what happens in the classroom that produces that.
By a long way. So I look at, you know, what we do at our school, and it's three afternoons, long afternoons of sport every week, which is three half days of school, and community action, that's another afternoon of school. You know, so there's lots and lots of stuff going on. But underneath it all, I mean, there are amazing opportunities here and that sort of thing. But underneath it all, it's pretty much just like any other school. It's just, you know, when I was 14 years old, there was a teacher's strike. And when the teachers came back off strike, it was about workload. And there were no longer any fixtures against other schools, sporting fixtures against other schools, for example. And that's just a direct example of how not funding something enough is not going to make it. It's just going to reduce its quality, and that's that.
Yeah. We did this stuff on the purpose of education years ago, didn't we? But it'll be interesting to think about what that would look like now, given current constraints, and now they're a bit older and a bit wiser, hopefully, etc.
Yeah.
Okay, what should we do next?
Let's have a look. Domain paper scissors. Why would we?
Yeah, so this is Lauren Haywood from Reclaim Hosting, she's with Tim Owens and Jim Group, and she did a workshop. I think it was at Coventry. Yeah, Coventry University's Domain of One's Own initiative at the Disruptive Media Learning Lab. And the thing I really liked about this, just a simple little thing, really, in the same way that we've prototyped badges before at MozFest by cutting things out and sticking them on, she gets them to, like, it's almost like a worksheet that you cut out and you design what your very first website's going
to
look like.
All right, yes, this is, I did something similar to this at MozFest last year, where you just take a piece of paper and you say, right, what's going to be on it? Here's a domain of your own. What are you going to put on it? You're going to have an element of this and an element of that, a box saying this, you know, and you plan it out on a piece of paper to start you thinking about it. And it's quite an interesting process, as drawing always is. I saw something this week. Can I just say this while we're here? Because I didn't pursue it. I didn't have time, and I didn't save it to pursue later. And I should have done. But it was that some people did a test about remembering things. And if you draw the picture rather than write the word, so you say you're learning a language and you draw the picture of the word rather than writing it, everyone remembers it better. It's just a standard human thing. It's really interesting, I thought. So if you get, you know, you're doing, like, there's a lot of keywords in any subject in a school, that need to be learned in every subject. And if you get them to draw pictures of those words, they remember the words much better than if,
I honestly think we've got different parts of the... I mean, I'm no kind of psychologist or neuroscientist, but I tell you what I've really noticed, and my wife and I have been talking about this. So my daughter is now six and a half, okay? And she's losing all her front teeth and all that kind of stuff. And she can still remember being very small. She can remember being 2-3 years old. She can talk in detail about stuff that, you know, it's not just coming from photos, yeah? But she's talking all the time to the extent that we're having to tell her to shut up and stop interrupting our conversations. And, you know, my wife teaches year one, and she said, it's always the same in year one. And I've got this perhaps completely off the wall belief that there's a documented fact that when kids get to 7-8 years old, they lose some of their early memory. And I think that's caused by the fact that they store those memories in very visual ways, as opposed to having it mediated by language, you know, all their memories stored by words, etc. So I'm wondering whether this explosion in her talking even more all the time, doesn't shut up, is something to do with that, and kind of reinterpreting memories and getting rid of some, etc. In which case, this is almost what we're talking about here, a more primitive form of remember.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about it, the brain is a very visual entity. So I think about memories from my childhood, and all of memories by definition are pictures. They're not conversations particularly. Although I remember when I was younger, I could remember every word that I ever said. And it was very weird. So when I had a conversation with someone years later or a couple of years later, I could recall the exact conversation in detail. And my brain is nothing like that anymore. But that's possibly because my brain used to focus on the wrong things when I was that age.
I did a fascinating module, and I did the philosophy of art in the second year at doing my philosophy degree. And there was a part of that about dreaming, and that was fascinating, because it was both the philosophy and psychology of dreaming, and nobody really knows how it works. And we also did the philosophy of horror. That was one of my favorite modules. It was great.
The philosophy of horror.
Yeah, like why do people go and intentionally get sick.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely fascinating as well. So it's about causing that physical reaction in brain and body. It's about being knowing where you are in relation to the thing, and the fact that you're having a reaction is greater, is more important than having no reaction and just being incredibly passive. You don't feel like you're passive when you're watching a horror movie. You feel like you're getting pushed around by it, you know.
And it's the same. I mean, that kind of watching a horror film by yourself or something scary by yourself is different to watching it with someone else, and depending on who that other person is as well. And the same with comedy. Like, if you sit and watch comedy by yourself, you might occasionally laugh out loud, but that's possibly because you've seen it before and watched it with someone else. If you watch something for the first time by yourself, I don't know about you, Di, but it's very rare that I would.
Oh, no, I didn't. So I live on my own, and I don't ever do any comedy. Very rarely. There are certain things that I do sometimes. When I find a comedian, I'll get down a rabbit hole with a comedian that I like. But I don't watch comedy programs, but I did when I lived in, with my family, and I had people around me all of the time. Because you have that common thing of laughing together. It's quite interesting. I miss it in a way, but I just don't. Whenever I have a choice, I think, "Oh, comedy, yeah, I don't want to watch that," for whatever reason. I just don't be very funny.
Well, yeah, social.
But there are some people who are incredibly funny, and there are some people who are not. Have you know what's his name? Stuart, comedian. Stuart Lee. Do you know him? Obviously, you know his name.
I read his comedy Guardian. I haven't watched much of his comedy.
I find his stand-up comedy to be the best there is out there, and I thoroughly recommend watching, going on YouTube and looking up Stuart Lee in Top Gear. That is a difficult watch and absolutely hilarious. I promise you will enjoy it.
Okay, so he's being interviewed on Top Gear.
No, it's him doing a stand-up line about Top Gear. When Top Gear was much in the news, it's a couple of years old now. It's very good. All right. I thoroughly recommend anyone watching it. Very funny.
Cool. I just wanted, while we're talking about families and parenting and all that kind of stuff, I wanted to put this link in here. So in The Guardian, I've actually started to really enjoy consuming The Guardian via The Guardian app. I'm paying my £2.50 a month to be a supporter or whatever it is. I think you can up it to £5, but it's not clear what you get for the £5 or whatever. And it's ad-free. The thing which knocks me about that, actually, Di, before we go on, is that to prove that I've paid for it and to stop the annoying, it would be great if you paid for this, I have to sign into an account. And it keeps asking me to personalize it. And I don't want to personalize it. I want the full fee.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? And then, but when you have personalized it, so I've played about with this a little bit. I do the crosswords on there as well. The feed still comes as a normal feed. It doesn't personalize the feed. The paper still remains the paper in its main feed, but you can click on your profile, little portrait picture cartoon thing, and it gives you what you've asked for. But I swear that mine is not what I've asked for. I swear they've got it wrong. So I follow particular reporters, but it doesn't. So what I really want, a notification, is when those reporters, like Stuart Lee, for example, write a new article, and it just doesn't do that. They're missing a trick there, I think, because it would be interesting. Because I do think that the quality of journalism is an important thing, and when you like the way that somebody writes about something and you get to know their depth of investigation and the context in which they're writing from, the position which they're writing from as well, you want more about
it. Like I really enjoyed I enjoy Marina Hyde because she obviously knows her stuff politically, but also she writes it with such a comedy style that it's
And then you get some who are you get to know how tech savvy some journalists are as well. So they're not writing for clickbait, because they understand what they're writing about. So therefore, when I read it, I'm not thinking, they haven't thought about this or they haven't thought about that. Do you know what I mean? I know that.
No, they're creating a body of work. One of the things, so Tim Lott's column is a tiny little section at the back of the review every mm-hmm. Saturday. And it's wonderful. This particular one, so he reflects on family life, etc. And this particular one, he weaves together using mobile devices and smartphones, etc., in front of children, along with his visit to the Hay Festival, where he went to see Luciana Floridi, who's a professor of philosophy and ethics of information at the University of Oxford. And he's written a book called The Fourth Revolution. So he's talking about the default position that we have, that using your phone all the time in front of children is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he says this, which is great. How much attention are we meant to give our children anyway? Lovable though their relentless egocentricness is, they can afford to be ignored occasionally, or at least not get the 100% focus we seem to have come to believe they need from parents. Such a level of attention would probably be unwelcome, rather than that, like living in a pre-Glasnost surveillance state. Think of all the things they wouldn't be able to get away with if they had our attention all the time.
Well, that's right.
And he goes on, he says, last paragraph, parents, it's time to stop feeling guilty if you occasionally privilege your screens over your children. They certainly don't feel guilt when they privilege their screens over you. But there's a wider world in those pixels. It shouldn't efface human interaction, but neither should we resist the infosphere, because now that the fourth revolution has arrived, we are all citizens of that place. And for all its flaws, it's a rich, fascinating, and ever-evolving world.
Well, so I agree with that, and I don't agree with it. So I'd like to see him there. So the point for me about this that pokes me a little bit is that what you do on your screen are different things. And sometimes you might be working, and actually sometimes work is important, and sometimes your children can just wait. You know, and I think that's, I think as a parent, you have to have the confidence to see yourself doing that, but also to be able to do it, which I sympathize with the article a lot on that point. But I wish he'd put some kind of distinction about the amount of times that you do that or something, or what it is that you're doing on your screen. Sometimes, you know, if you're paying your bills or sorting the banking out or whatever, or earning some money, then it's important that you do that, even though you know it's inconvenient to your relationship with your child and not what your child needs at that time and things like that. I was just going to say,
I guess what I try and do is make it obvious what I'm doing on my device, so that and so often my wife will say, like, if you're working, you probably should go over to your office, because otherwise I'm like, oh, can you just be quiet, I'm doing this, whatever. Like, you have a place to go and work, off you go and work. If it's just a little thing, fair enough, but if you're doing a chunky bit of work, you should go into your office. And sometimes I'll just show Hannah or show my kids this thing that I'm looking at, to show that it's not just me staring and scrolling, as I call it.
Yes, it is, or discussing what it is that you're doing, and I think that's quite important. But I also think I'm dealing with something at the moment, which is, so we have mobile phones as part of the school uniform, and I've talked about the Screen Time Working Party that I've been contributing towards earlier in past episodes, and one of the things that. So it's possible that from year 9 to year 11, we'll have their phones will now have to be left at school. That's being proposed by that working party, which I don't agree with. It's being proposed by that working party. So I'm having to think about, or assemble argument about, that, look, if they have their phones with them, then they learn how to use their phones. And having their phones is a learning process. So that relationship to personal technology that's not shared with anybody else but themselves, that relationship needs to be learned, and it won't be a smooth thing. It won't just be like they get their phones and they get it right all the time. Mistakes will be made. And so you, adults modeling the use of these devices and them seeing you put it away to favor them, as well as sometimes you keeping it out, because to favor the work or whatever needs to be done, and explaining why you did that. That's really big learning stuff, because they're just going to get, you know, technology is going to be more pervasive for them than it is for us. And so I think the more that we can help them learn that, the better it is. And the more that we can help them just say, look, it's not all about you. I've got to do this because there's a mortgage to pay, and you know, you want some new shoes, and I need to make sure that I'm making a good income, and this is part of that.
No, I think knowing the consequence of your action is an important one. My kids were playing football outside before. There's a cable that goes pretty high up between our house and my office, which carries the power line and the telephone line and stuff. And obviously, if that got damaged, I wouldn't be able to work in here. And so I was getting quite annoyed by the fact that they were throwing the ball high in the air, because they didn't realize what would happen if anything got knocked or damaged or whatever. So yeah, seeing what the consequence of your actions are and being allowed to make mistakes, but then being corrected, is exactly what education and learning is about.
Yes, exactly. It is that. Right, take me on some user interface design.
Right. Well, yes. Okay. Just while we're doing family kind of stuff as well, we probably haven't got time to watch this at the same time. But this is a lovely thing. And when I shared it with my wife, she was like, "Why do we always see the cool things to do as a parent too late?" So this is I've been looking at various news aggregation sites for reasons that I didn't get to mention to you earlier, Di, before we started recording, which was, I want to put together, you know, like pop URLs or skim feed or something where it aggregates loads of different RSS feeds together for you to go and have a look at. I want us to do something like that for things that not only I would find useful, for other people would find useful as well, around a topic like open badges, digital literacies, whatever. So I was messing about with that, and I remembered that there was a one called AllTop, and AllTop has a special kind of blog to it called Holy Cow or Holy Core or something. And on this, long story short, there's a wonderful YouTube video which a dad for 12 years took a short video of his daughter having just going to school for the first time that year. And you see her grow up all the way through, and he goes the first day of her first ever day at school, then the first day of her last year at school, and then he goes, so you can see the difference, then he goes all the way through, and then he goes backwards as well. And it's just lovely. And it's the kind of thing that I think we're going to do with my daughter, especially because she's in year one, on the last day of the school year, because obviously we missed the first day of the school year.
I think that's a really good idea, isn't it? Because it's, I will go and have a look at that, because I think it's one of the things that technology affords, isn't it? So I always wish that when my children were 18 that I'd taken a picture of them on their every birthday to have the 18 years. And that I'd made, and that I had those, you know, even just by 4x6s, but printed out on and framed and on the wall, just in small pictures, just as so you can see them growing. Because I always find it such a moving, like looking at them as they have grown, in it's such a moving thing. I always wished I'd done that. So I'd be really interested.
What I really like about these videos are that you see not just this daughter physically growing up into a woman, but you see the fact that like 6-year-olds can't keep still, and going through the awkward kind of 12-year-old.
Yes, absolutely. And the different attitudes and the way that they speak, and you can see so much, can't you, in just what I imagine is short bits of speech.
Talking about grumpy teenagers, actually, before we go on to the UX stuff, which is great, and I really want to make sure we get to that, on kotka.org, so Jason Cocker's blog, which has been going, I think, one of the longest blogs on the internet, it's a YouTube video, but you can just read the 7 things. It says, "The internet is chock full of articles and videos on how to be happier, but why chase happiness when making yourself miserable is much easier? In this video, CGP Grey shares 7 tactics to maximize your misery." And of course, it's just the inverse of the stuff you should do.
We will. Number one is stay still.
2, screw around with your sleep.
3, maximize your screen time.
4, use your screen to stoke your negative emotions.
5, set vapid goals.
6. 6, pursue happiness directly.
You're gone then. 7, follow your instincts. That's very good. I like that.
Yes. It says the video is based on Randy Patterson's recent book, How to Be Miserable, 40 Strategies You Already Use.
It is. I always like... in fact, it's one of the techniques that I use in conversation with most people about things, is that I look at what somebody is saying to me, and then, and especially when they're making a judgment about something, and I just flip it completely upside down. And that's exactly what that's doing. Mm. And just because it's always much more interesting when talking to someone to look at it from the other side of where they're looking at something. And if you can get someone to look at something from another angle, they really enjoy it, generally, I find. Anyway, yeah. There you go.
And they should be able to, it's a bit like when you do surveys and you check someone's answer by asking them the inverse of the question you asked earlier.
Yes, absolutely.
Earlier.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Cool. Okay. Let's get on to the critical analysis of notification systems, because I think this is really good. So this is on a blog. It's a Medium Power blog called uxdesign.cc. And what I like about it is it talks about the way... So it talks about, it starts off with this really nice image of, how do you describe a die? It looks like the world, and what's the other thing?
An opposing force to the world. So a darkened version of it, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, like the opposite of the world. Like
death, life and death, you could argue, possibly. I don't know. The underworld.
The caption is, the constant tension between focus on one's world versus the need to be informed or notified. It's almost like we talked ages ago about James Clear's fantastic blog post about the difference between, and I think this comes from the 7 habits of highly effective people, which is the circle of control and the circle of concern. You know, you should try and keep your circle of concern as big as possible and your circle of concern like the same size as your circle of control. Otherwise, if you have a small circle of control and a large circle of concern, it means you feel no agency.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, makes sense.
It talks about the difference between Android and iOS when it comes to notification systems.
Because I have an iPad and I hate the notification system on it, whereas my Android I find to be pretty much straightforward, except for something that one of my pupils coined the phrase to me, Google trash. That's just Google. I said, what are all these notifications? Oh, it's just Google trash, sir. And it's because Google.
Well, I think you're right. I think Android is better than iOS for notifications, although there's important critiques of both. So if you scroll down to the iOS notification system, Shankar, yes, he says, where was it? iOS notification system is a timeline. It's a passive aggressive system that interrupts you only once with every notification and then pushes the notification into a timeline, a steady stream of alerts that are triggered from various sources. And then if you scroll down a bit, he talks about what that means. So you see the bit in italics where he's talking about Bob?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Let's say Bob is on an iPhone.
Right.
So let's say Bob is on an iPhone. He has a dozen Instagram notifications above a text message notification from Mum. To worsen things, in a few hours, there are so many notifications in the notification center that he cannot go through each of them. He clears them all.
So he says, the guy writing this blog post says that this creates an imbalance. The most important notifications are lost in the shuffle, as it is overwhelming to look at a huge stream of alerts in a single place. On top of that, iOS treats every notification as its own cell and does not group multiple notifications into one. Now, I'm not sure, I haven't really looked at the announcement because I don't care, but I'm sure iOS 11 will do something with this. But let's just go back up to Android, which I think does things better, but still not perfectly.
I'm there. Okay.
So, and the great thing about this is he's got diagrams to illustrate his point. He says, let's understand how Android's notification system works in general. Some kind of trigger results in a notification being created. For our example of a notification, let's take a direct message on LinkedIn. As soon as a notification arrives, Android pushes it to the lock screen or top area if unlocked, and collects an app icon in the status tray to signify an unattended notification. Swipe down from the top or view the lock screen to view a list of all the notifications you have. And it puts them up like a stack of cards, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So I find this effective. And once you're familiar with the notifications that come, I end up you can, if so on Android, the nice thing that you can do is on the notifications, on the actual notification that you receive, is you can kind of pull it down a little bit, expand it a little bit, and it gives you a little cog that allows you to choose the notifications for that app. So you can turn the notifications for that app off. So I get notifications for the weather, for example, and I'm not really interested in receiving those. And then I realize they're on my screen all of the time. But then what that gives you is a sense of, well, if I haven't got a notification, something's wrong. A phone without notifications.
And you can get rid of individual notifications from a particular app, which is quite nice. But let's just go through the example here, Di. So the bit where it says Bob receives
notification. Bob receives a notification triggered by a message on LinkedIn. He ignores it for now as he is trying to focus on something else. Now, every time he passes through the lock screen, this notification is right there reminding him of an action he needs to take. While it is great that the system is collecting all things that he has to get back to, this also becomes a distraction, since the system is implicitly assuming that Bob needs to get to them now. And I think that's absolutely right.
Now, this is the kind of thing that at Stanford, the Calm Computing Lab was trying to get around. So, you know, computers are very good at basically being like alarm clocks all the time and just jumping up and down saying, deal with this immediately, which is what every notification is like. But if you scroll right down, there's a wonderful diagram of what this guy would see in terms of cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See that? So it's like a big like reddish sphere, which is titled Triggers Outside Your Close Circle of Connections, brackets external world. And then it's got two overlapping green circles, triggers close to you, including yourself, your internal world. So if you think about it, the phone knows where you are because of GPS. So it knows what's important right now, whether you're at home or work or whatever. It knows who you call all the time, and you can infer close relationships and stuff. So it should be able to do a better job in terms of notifications. And the question which he asks, which I've seen people at Google ask before, is how might we do this better?
I've got two things to say on this. One is if we hark back to when Apple released their watch first, we talked about watches a lot. We discussed notifications in detail, and we mentioned all of this, that technology had to get better at how it delivered notifications to you. The thing you wear on your wrist, you've got specific notifications set up, haven't you, for it to buzz or something?
Yeah, so just to remind people, I've got a Sony Smartband. It's an e-ink display. It doesn't really let me do much apart from see that I've got a notification and dismiss them. And I've got that set up so it just triggers on Signal, Telegram, text messages.
Yeah, so it's just certain notifications. And that's it. And technology should be about customizing your notification for the reasons cited in this article, which is exceptional, I think. And the other thing I'd like to say is that the closest thing I've seen to this, so I started using OK Google, or, well, not really OK Google, actually, started using just the voice input on my phone to set reminders. And those reminders are really lovely. So I set a reminder and I anticipate the time of day when I know I'm going to have space to deal with that thing, or I have to deal with it. So I get a reminder to deal with it. And then what I can do is snooze that reminder for an hour. So when it pops up, it puts it in my head that it's coming, but I snooze it so it's not on my phone and it's not a notification until the next hour comes and it pops up again, and then it's persistent on the phone until I either dismiss it or snooze it. And that's, I find that really helpful. So that's an example of how, because of the U green circle, things that I've set for myself to do and I want to be notified about, because I consider them to be very important for me to get done. Excellent.
Yeah, there's an app called Cloud Magic. I think it's called Cloud Magic. If you come across that, it's like it allows you to connect your email inboxes on like Microsoft,
Google, et cetera. I used to use Cloud Magic for my old email until I thought third party was not okay.
So the nice thing about that is it integrates with Evernote and Trello and everything like that. So you can set an action directly from your email inbox. And what I'd like to see is being able to choose a trigger from a notification. So I think we don't abstract enough away from our technology. You know, we've been talking about using Linux and thinking about what the app does rather than that it's shiny and free and everyone's using it and stuff. So for example, with Trello, I'm using Trello, but it could be anything that allowed me to do Kanban style, you know, to do, doing and done style lists. So what I'd like to do is to be able to go, I've got a notification that says I need to do this thing, press it, and then just like almost drag it into my to-do list on my Kanban board, which would seem like a no-brainer, but there's no way of doing that at the moment.
This is quite interesting. So Cloud Magic, which I used to use, is now turned into Newton, it's called. So obviously towards the end of 2016, it's died and been purchased. They're calling it Spacer Supercharged Emailing with Space Age Features that put you on top of the world. And then it has a picture of the new moon rather than the world. But no, the principle is absolutely right. And that's what IFTTT is about in a way, isn't it? If this, then that. It's just about making the stuff that's out there work for you and do that.
The Engadget review of Newton. The subtitle is, the team behind Cloud Magic built an excellent email experience, but good luck charging $50 a year for it.
Oh, is that what Newton is for?
Just about what it costs. So yeah, I think there's a lot of work to be done on notification systems. I'm sure it's a pretty hard problem to solve given the plethora of apps and, you know, common ways of doing things and frameworks. So it would have to be done at the system level. And interestingly, you know, Apple announced their AR features, which I think has scuppered Facebook's plans. And I did read an interesting thing earlier, which I'll be able to find quickly now, but it was talking about how Facebook massively failed in trying to create a gaming experience within Facebook. Because it couldn't control it, Apple didn't allow them to put an app store within Facebook's app on iOS,
right,
etc. So it has to be done at the people who make the operating system level. It can't be done by anyone else.
Have you ever used a GPS trigger for anything, like on IFTTT or anything else?
Only in messing about, nothing.
Yeah, no, so I've tried it with mostly changing the notification settings, the volume, you know, to vibrate and to silent, depending if when I walk into my classroom. And I've always found the GPS incredibly inaccurate.
Yeah, well, I started doing it actually. So, you know, you mess about with features and stuff. So I still use the McAfee Safe Family app with my son's device, phone. And I had it set so that when he went into the like geofence or whatever of his school, it went onto his phone, went to silent, but then I ended up just changing it based on time. So it basically just, as is very easy to do on Android phones and iOS, I think, you know, automatically goes into vibrate mode when it's 5 to 9.
Yes, which makes enormous sense, obviously. So I tried doing that through GPS. I was just wondering whether that's got any better or not. I remember doing it and having all location turned on and everything to see if I could make my device serve me well, better, and it didn't work.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? We're both using Android, we're both using Linux, yeah, which are massively customizable. You can spend your whole life figuring out very technical stuff, new workflows, etc. There's been times this week when I've just thought, you know what? Part of me just wants an iPhone, iPad, Apple Watch, Apple AirPods, or whatever they're called, and a MacBook, because my life was a lot easier when I had some of those things. But then I was really frustrated because they weren't massively customizable. So the grass is always green.
I think so. I don't agree. I've never wanted to live in one ecosystem. Maybe, I never have, so maybe that's why. Maybe people who are living in it are all going, woohoo, what on earth do you think you're doing?
I didn't know. Waking up in a utopia in the morning.
No,
I don't think so. Right, we should wrap this up. We're at 1 hour 37 minutes, which is an accurate timeline because we're not just recording part of our conversation. We've actually hit record on Zencastr, and we're about to hit stop on Zencastr when we finish recording. For those who are interested in this, you can invite people in on different plans. So we're just going to use the free one. And there's little kind of things you can add to it. Like you can add sound effects.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
That's beautiful, isn't it?
Intros and outros and drum beats and, you know, rim shots and all that kind of stuff. But we'll not do that for the time being. Dai, what are you up to this next week?
Do you know what? I'd thought of what I was going to be doing. But I can't remember. off the top of my head now because it's late. It's 10:30.
Okay. Well, I am doing this research for about open practices in the NHS. I'm working on Badge Wiki. That's all up and running now and installed. And so, although when you go to badge.wiki, you'll see the holding page. You know, there's a website, the wiki behind that, which we're working on. Got someone to install that and secure it, which is good. Next Monday, I am up in Dundee, University of Dundee, doing the closing keynote at an Open Badges conference. So looking forward to that. And then I am overdue writing a blog post about what Open Badges, what version 2 of the Open Badges specification allows you to do. That will probably take me to the end of Thursday. And Friday, I am going to do Bugger All.
Fair enough. Something I did want to say, not that I'm going to do, but that I've done, was yesterday I went to Stowe School, which is a very, very beautiful school. So it's set in 750 acres, private boarding school. But it's the 750 acres are owned by the National Trust and kept by the National Trust. And the house in the middle where the school is kept by Stowe House Preservation Society or something. Trust, something, I don't know. Anyway, very beautiful. So there I met this gentleman who at 58 years old has left the IT industry and moved into teaching. And he'd been teaching at the school since January. He's a programmer. He built the system that runs the Department of Welfare and Pensions for the Irish government. So it's an enormous system. I was there to learn about object-oriented programming. And it was fascinating talking to him or listening to him talk about setting standards within the organization, standards of software, things like he insisted that the date of birth must be hidden from the system and no one could ever read the date of birth because it was one of the only secure pieces of information that a user could actually give without being given it. So you wouldn't be asked to confirm your date of birth by saying it out loud. The employee wouldn't say the date of birth out loud, so the customer would have to give it, and you just type it in, and it would say whether it was their date of birth or not. It wouldn't be a visual verification. And he wanted it hidden away, and just the way that he discussed data in that detail was fascinating, because I think that's absolutely right, because it just threw back to me. Do you remember that article that we talked about time ago now, where all software had been designed badly? It could have been designed so much more securely. But security was never a priority at the time. It just struck me that what we needed was more fastidious people like him who understood the importance of standards in programming, because you see how all of this software is now pervasive in our lives and very, very difficult to re-engineer with the necessary security on board. So, interesting.
But it's all speed to market, I guess, these days. So, which is why I think that partly the, hey, let's go into government and do crazy things and move fast and all that kind of stuff. I think gov.uk did a good job, but, you know, public-private partnerships where it's always going to be speed to market, profit, all that kind of stuff is...
Yeah, no, that was absolutely right. Anyway. Just to mention, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, he worked for the Irish government for 15 years, has his own company now and works part-time as a teacher. So he was in for the long haul and making sure they got the very best system. And he also said that the senior people in the Irish government know how to talk in object-oriented programming language, as in they know how to talk about objects and classes and inheritance and such like, and they understand that. And that was part of what he did. Interesting. Anyway, on that note...
Excellent. Well, we will be recording, I guess, next Tuesday again. So until then, thank you for listening, everybody. And have a good week, Dan.
You too. Bye, everyone.
Sitting on a darker bay.